Good evening and welcome to the Archie MacDonald Speakers Series, recorded for broadcast on April 12, 2012 at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas. Archie's guest tonight is the Honorable James A. Baker III. Brian Murphy, Dean of the College of Liberal and Applied Arts, will open this program.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the third annual Archie MacDonald Speaker Series event at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas. My name is Brian Murphy. I'm Dean of the College of Liberal and Applied Arts, and my job is to give you a little bit of a background on the event tonight. This speaker series promotes the legacy of Dr. Archie MacDonald. He of the always present Stetson hat, which we will see in a minute, and always insightful comments about us as Americans. His lifetime of work has deepened our understanding of American culture, informed us of who we are as a nation, and clarified what makes us different in a chaotic and global world. Archie has managed to capture the soul of American culture in a way that few have ever accomplished through his academic writing, teaching, newspaper articles, and radio commentaries. To quote Dr. MacDonald, America's real promise is the stuff of spirit, conscience, and ideals. If we want that badly enough, we must understand where we've been in order to get to where we are going. This series is designed to present people who have contributed to the shaping of our American identity, an identity that Dr. MacDonald has made authentic for us. Tonight, we learn about a man who has influenced our culture by example, courage, and always with dignity, Mr. James A. Baker III. Now, it is my honor to introduce Dr. Baker Petillo, president of Stephen F. Austin State University. His legacy is all around us, a university made great.
Tonight, it is my privilege to introduce and present to you the man that our speaker series is named for, Dr. Archie P. MacDonald. Dr. MacDonald holds a Bachelor of Science degree from Lamar University, a Master of Arts degree from Rice University, a PhD from Louisiana State University. He has taught at Rice University. He has taught at Louisiana State University. He has taught at Murray State University. He has taught at Central Washington State University. And, of course, he has taught at Stephen F. Austin State University. In fact, he has taught history here at SFA since 1964, or for 48 years. During that period of time, he has held the academic rank of assistant professor, associate professor, full professor, alumni distinguished professor, and regent professor. For 37 years, he served as director of the East Texas Historical Association. Also, he has written 52 books. And in addition, at the current time, he serves as chairman of the Red River Radio Community Advisory Board. And in addition, every Friday morning, he broadcasts a commentary. Some time ago, Mr. Kermit Poland, who is station manager, referred to Dr. MacDonald as Red River's rock star. Dr. MacDonald is married to Judy MacDonald, the former mayor of Nacogdoches. They have been blessed with two sons and one granddaughter. At this time, it is my privilege to present to you Dr. Archie P. MacDonald, the man that Red River Radio refers to as their rock star, but we know he is SFA's superstar. At this time, Dr. Archie P. MacDonald.
I guess hanging around here for five decades or so has some consequences one never anticipates at the beginning. Also like to thank my family, especially my beloved wife, Judy, who is here with us this evening, for their love and support as well. Now it's my pleasure to introduce the Honorable James A. Baker III, our special guest and honoree of the speaker series. Secretary Baker grew up in Houston surrounded by lawyers, especially his grandfather and father, so there's no little wonder that he ended up a jurist himself. A graduate of Princeton University, a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps during the Korean conflict, Secretary Baker has a distinguished record of public service, beginning as Undersecretary of the Department of Commerce in the administration of President Gerald Ford, Chief of Staff and then Treasury Secretary for President Ronald Reagan, Secretary of State and again Chief of Staff in the administration of his longtime friend President George H.W. Bush, and troubleshooter for lots of other administrations, not to mention campaign manager in 5 presidential campaigns. Secretary Baker also has a couple of unique connections here. His grandfather was one of the original owners of Commercial National Bank, our oldest financial institution, and we share this. That same grandfather saved William Marsh Rice's fortune from swindlers and murderers and made possible that wonderful institute, now university, down in Houston that stretched its admission standards to admit even me in 1958 as a master's candidate. So now I finally get to thank a member of the Baker family for making that part of my education possible. And it's now my pleasure to invite Secretary James A. Baker to join me here on the stage for our conversation.
Thank you, Archie.
I know you've been welcomed many times already to our campus and to our community, but I'm certainly going to do that once more. We're delighted to have you here for this conversation, and we'll invite these friends to join in our celebration of America itself. Let's get down to the visit now. I know from previous conversations with you and reading some of the things you've written that family is a very important thing for you, both, you know, sort of vertically, the grandfather and the father and so forth in the firm. And in public life to a degree in Texas, and the blended family that surrounds you. Well, let's talk about those Bakers and all those numbers. I think there actually have been 4, but you are the 3rd by name. How'd that happen?
Well, there have actually, well, first of all, let me say I'm delighted to be here with you, Archie, and delighted to be at Stephen F. Austin and in Nacogdoches. There are 5 of them. There have been 5.
5.
Yep, and I'm really the 4th. But when I came along, my great-grandfather was not living, so they named me the 3rd, which I thought was a great break because it sounds too much like royalty if you're called the 4th. My poor son is James A. Baker the 5th, but we don't call him that. We call him the 4th. And the good news is, maybe the good news is that he had 5 girls. So there isn't a 5th.
Sounds to me like there's some real meaning in numerology here. We ought to leave that alone.
Right.
Well, tell me now about those 5 P's that were so important to that grandfather of yours. Previous preparation prevents poor performance. Now, that's kind of been a mantra for your life.
Well, I tell people, say, what's the key to good leadership? What's the key to the success you've enjoyed in politics and public service, or in the practice of law for that matter? And I said, well, you know, it's a very simple thing. It's something my father drilled into me when I was a young man. He used to tell me all the time, don't forget, Jimmy, prior preparation prevents poor performance. And it's true. I think if you, you know, a lot of people, particularly in politics, will go out and try and wing it. You don't do that. You shouldn't do that in business. You shouldn't do it in law. You shouldn't do it in politics. And you certainly shouldn't do it in public service when you're representing your country in an important office. So it's been something that's been very important to me, not just in my public life, but in my personal life as well.
Sounds to me like it's a pretty good way to live, too. You know what's going to happen when you're prepared for it to come up that way.
If you get prepared, you don't get embarrassed, right?
That's right. Now, I talked a moment ago about the Rice saga, and your grandfather had a major role in saving that fortune. Let's go into that case a little bit, because I know that's also been quite important in the legacy of the university that it enabled when he prevailed.
Well, first of all, my grandfather was Mr. William Marsh Rice's lawyer in Houston, Texas. Mr. Rice came to Houston from New York and made a fortune in cotton and timber. As he got older in age, he lost a wife. He moved back to New York. Before he left, he told my grandfather, didn't have any children, told my grandfather he wanted to leave his estate to the formation of an institute of higher learning in Houston, Texas. And my grandfather wrote a will for him to that effect. After he'd been back in New York maybe for, I think, 5 to 10 years, I can't remember the exact amount of time, my grandfather got a telegram one day that said, Mr. Rice died in his sleep last night under mysterious circumstances, or of unknown causes, or something like that. And I don't know why grandfather smelled a rat, but he did. One reason might have been that a draft for $25,000 had been sent down to a Houston bank, payable to the order of a lawyer in New York who had done some legal work for Mr. Rice. My grandfather smelled a rat, and he said, don't do anything with the body. I'm on my way up there. Well, in those days, on my way up there was 2.5 to 3 days. You know, you didn't hop on an airplane and fly up there. And he went up there, and to make a long story short, he finally figured out that the old man had been murdered. And guess what? It was a perfect murder mystery because the butler did it.
Yeah.
And the butler did do it. Mr. Rice had a butler who was sort of half-witted, and this unscrupulous New York lawyer had gotten a hold of him, and they'd poisoned the old man. Grandfather sniffed it all out, got the authorities involved. There was a long trial. The unscrupulous New York lawyer was convicted and sentenced to a very long term in jail. Mm-hmm. His sentence was ultimately commuted. I don't know whether he ever got out or not. His name was Albert Patrick. If you go to the early volumes of the Northeast Reporter, a law book, you'll see an account of that case, and it really does read just like it should as a murder mystery.
You gave me a copy of that. I enjoyed looking at it.
Yeah.
Well, I am delighted, and I do thank you for that, as do other generations of Texans because of that institution, now university, of course. And I'm just going to ask you one more question about it before we move on to some more contemporary things. But I wouldn't fail to give you a chance to comment on the James A. Baker Institute that's now associated on the campus. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you care to say a few words about it?
Sure, I'd be happy to. First of all, let me say one more thing about my grandfather.
Sure.
My grandfather was the first chairman of the board of Rice University, and he served as such for 50 years. He was the longest serving chairman of Rice's board. He died in 1941. They created a residential college on the campus of Rice University that they call Baker College. Mm-hmm. In 1992, after we were involuntarily retired from public service, the chairman of the board of Rice University and the president came to see me in my office in the White House, and they said, you know, we have a suggestion from one of our professors here that we create a public policy institute in your name at Rice University. Would you have any problem with that? I said, no, I would be honored. If you did that, that would be a great honor for me. And there are only two conditions that I would put on it. Number one, I would not like to see it grant a degree because I had learned about the experience of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton and the Kennedy School at Harvard and some other entities like that. If it's a degree-granting entity, then the faculty of that institute get crossways with the regular faculty at the university. So we are strictly a public policy institute, a think tank. We don't grant a degree, never have. We're now 19 years old now we are. We're thinking for the first time maybe of granting a master's in public administration or something like that. Probably we'll do it, but by now we are totally accepted by everybody on the Rice campus, administration, faculty. There's no internecine warfare, there's no jealousy or anything else. And they're quite proud of the fact that we're there. And so if we were going to do it, now's the time to do it. The second condition I said was, I'm happy, it's an honor for me, provided I don't have to raise the money. And guess what? I had to raise a fair amount of the money.
I imagine.
But with a university like Rice University, which is such a wonderful academic institution, they've been extraordinarily supportive, and we've done really very well.
And the view is pretty international in what you do there.
We do. Well, we do both international. We decided early on that we were not going to be a niche public policy institute, that we were going to take advantage of my experience in politics, my experience in economics as Treasury Secretary, domestic issues, and international. So we cover the full gamut of issues. We have health policy, tax policy, international issues, and So we do.
No, it's a full-service place.
Full-service policy institute.
Now, let's move on a little bit into your own career as we've started this. Baker Botts obviously existed there, grandfather and father being founders and sustainers of the firm, but you didn't go to work for them.
No. Well, they had a nepotism rule at the time. Baker Botts was started, if you can believe it, in 1840. Texas was a republic. We were not a state in the Union. It was started by a man named Peter Gray. He became a law partner with a man named W.B. Botts. In 1872, my great-grandfather, James A. Baker, who was a friend of Sam Houston's, had been a Confederate States judge on the district court that included Harris and Grimes and some other counties down there. And when we lost the Civil War, they kicked him off the court. And he went to Houston and lined up with Gray and Botts, and that was how Baker Botts got started. I didn't go there because when I got out of law school, even though I was on the law review and everything, they had an anti-nepotism rule. I never will forget one day, my dad went to the office one morning. He said, "You know, son," he said, "the firm's going to take a look at the anti-nepotism rule since you have the grades and everything, and you are, after all, at that time I was the fourth James A. Baker to come along out of law school." And he came home that night and he said, "Well, they decided not to make an exception to the nepotism rule." And I was really hurt by that. But I want to tell you, it's the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. Because if I had gone to work for Baker Botts and I had succeeded, everybody would have said, "Well, what do you expect? He succeeded because of his father." And if I'd failed, they'd say, "What do you expect? He was only here because of his father." So it was really something very fortunate that happened to me. And I went to work for an extraordinarily fine Houston firm, Andrews, Kirk, Campbell, and Jones. I was hired by a man who has some interest up here in this part of the world, Melvin Kurth, a wonderful boss. I had a great experience there for 22 years.
So it worked out after all.
It worked out.
And then you came back, though, after public service.
Well, here's what happened on that.
And you broke the rule. Now.
Here's what happened after that. After I ran the Ford campaign in 1976 and I got a lot of national attention, Baker Botts came to me after we lost to Carter. And they said, Baker Botts said, "You know, you need to get your ticket punched at the family firm. Come on over and join us." I said, "No, I really don't think I ought to do that. I got a lot of good friends. They've been very good to me at Andrews Kurth. They're still there. I'm going to go back there." And I did. Then after I went back up to Washington for another 12 years to be with Reagan, Bush, and then Bush won. And we lost in 92. They came back to me again. Well, by that time, all of my contemporaries at Andrews Kurth had retired or gone on. And so I joined the firm. One big hitch, my dad was dead. And so there wasn't another Baker above me there, but my son, James A. Baker, the fourth, was a partner in the Washington office. And so the nepotism rule would have applied. You can't have a father and son. Somebody came to my son and said, "Jamie, how can your dad come to the firm in the face of the nepotism rule?" Jamie said, "Don't you understand? The nepotism rule works. It works down. It doesn't work up."
Doesn't work up. One way. And that's probably a good alteration of the rule. Well, let's move on now to your friendship with George H.W. Bush. I know that predates any political activity or anything else and continues to this day just tied as tree bark. That bond is really so strong that you've left other positions to be with him and to serve him so well. Tell us about George Bush.
Well, George Bush is one of the finest people you'll ever get to know. He's a man of great character, a great intellect, great intelligence. I tell people I was so fortunate to be able to serve in the cabinet of three extraordinarily wonderful human beings: Gerry Ford, Ronald Reagan, and George H.W. Bush. And I was fortunate as well to be able to do some work for George W. Bush as a private citizen. But George H.W. Bush is a longtime friend. We became acquainted when I moved back to Houston from law school in 1957 or 58. He moved to Houston from Midland, where he'd been running a law business. He got involved in politics in Houston at that time, ran for county chairman, did a few things like that as a Republican. In those days, being a Republican in Texas, anywhere in Texas, was a hanging offense. I mean, you didn't, you know what I'm talking about, and particularly maybe up here. And I was a Democrat. And so I didn't help him in his initial campaigns. Also, I was apolitical. I really never did much in politics because my grandfather had advice for the young lawyers joining Baker Boss: work hard, study, and keep out of politics, he used to say, if you want to be a good lawyer. Well, that was the mantra I followed for the first 40 years of my life. So I didn't do much with George at that time. But after I lost a wife to cancer, when she was only 38 years of age, he said, "You know, you need to do something about your grief. How about helping me run for the Senate here in Texas?" And I said, "Well, George, that's a great idea, except for two things. Number one, I don't know anything about politics. Sometimes I voted, but I didn't do much else. And secondly, I'm a Democrat." And he said, "Well, we can take care of that latter problem." And we did. And as I say, when I'm talking to a group of Republicans, I say I got religion. When I'm talking to a mixed group, I say I changed parties. Yeah. take it any way you want. But he's a wonderful man, wonderful, still extraordinarily wonderful human being. And if I had any success at all as Secretary of State, it was because of my seamless relationship with my president. That's the most important thing that a Secretary of State can have or needs if he's going to be he or she are going to be successful in Secretary of State.
But that kind of thing doesn't just happen. I know you all played tennis. You were tennis.
Well, we won a couple of tennis championships. Yeah, I'll tell you what happened when we both moved back to Texas. Neither one of us had a tennis partner in the Houston Country Club tennis tournament. They put us together. And that's pretty much how we got to be social friends. And then we got to be more than just that. We got to be political friends. And then we got to be public service colleagues.
Well, as we've just mentioned here, President Bush got you involved in all kinds of things I'm sure you never imagined as an undergraduate at Princeton or while serving in the Marine Corps or even a young lawyer in Houston, as you said. But you did get involved in all those things, and you've alluded here a moment ago to running that campaign for President Ford. And that's just the first. Let's talk a little bit about Jerry Ford. He sometimes drew a bum rap for awkwardness, and yet he's the greatest, one of the greatest athletes we've ever had as president.
He was. He was a wonderful athlete, and Chevy Chase used to do those skits, you know, where he, but Jerry Ford had a wonderful sense of humor, and Jerry Ford would poke fun at himself, you know, about those skits. But here again was an extraordinarily wonderful person. You know, he came into office at an extraordinarily difficult time for this country.
Absolutely.
And he was the right man for the job at that time. He restored our pride and confidence in ourselves. And he ran a terrific campaign. You know, on election day, he and Carter were dead even in the polls. He started 25 points behind. People don't remember this, particularly in light of what happened in Florida in 2000, where we only won by 537 votes in one state. But Ford only lost to Carter by 10,000 votes out of 81 million votes that were cast. If you turn 10,000 around in Ohio and Hawaii, Ford wins the Electoral College and Carter doesn't. He took his defeat gracefully. He didn't ask for recounts. He retired from public service. He pardoned Richard Nixon. And when we were running that campaign, when I was running that campaign and we were campaigning, we saw that every day in the polling. It hurt us a lot. But it was the right thing to do for the country. Ford concluded that the country could never put Watergate behind it as long as we were focusing on prosecuting a former president. We weren't a banana republic. It was the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do, but it cost him a lot.
Well, you know, there was another president who wrote a book called Profiles in Courage, and if he had kept on writing, that would have been a good chapter,
yes,
because I agree with you. I'll never forget hearing President Ford when we were on the radio because we were on our way to Colorado when he made that speech and made that pardon. And I said our long national nightmare
was
over.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there would have been a better way to get it over quicker than he did. He had a kind of an extraordinary first lady, too. I mean,
Betty,
outspoken
Betty was
lady.
Lovely lady, a lovely lady. And of course, then she established the Betty Ford Center, you know, mm-hmm. out there in California for recovering alcoholics, mm-hmm. and it's done, or substance abusers. And it's been a source of great help to many, many hundreds of people.
You know, I always had the sense, partisanship aside, whichever way, he was a decent man.
Jerry Ford? You can't find him.
He wouldn't get along with anybody if he could.
Well, and he was one of the best examples you can find of a Washington politician who knew how to reach across the aisle mm-hmm. and get things done. He knew how to be an adversary without being an enemy. He knew that's the way you govern. We've lost that in this country, and it's really too bad. I mean, our politics has gotten double ugly in Washington. Mm-hmm. It's now a zero-sum game. That's quite regrettable. A lot of it has to do with the proliferation of media outlets and with the internet, quite frankly, because people can throw up any kind of trash up there, see what sticks on the wall, and if some of it sticks, then sooner or later some news organization is going to run with it. It makes it very, very difficult. Another problem there is redistricting. Now, that's constitutional. You want to change that, you got to change the Constitution. Very difficult. But the capitals that are controlled by Democrats redistrict seats, safe seats for Democrats. Republicans do the same thing in the capitals they control. So the primaries become the important election. The general elections are not as important. And I bet you there's not 12 to 15 truly competitive seats in the Federal House of Representatives today because of redistricting.
And in the primaries, it seems you have to become whichever way your party leans, more extreme.
More extreme in order to get the nomination.
And the third
contributing factor, quite frankly, is the fact that the country is so evenly divided today between mm-hmm. blue states and red states. And so politics has become a zero-sum game to the detriment of the American people, because the government's not getting done. They're not doing what needs to be done. They're not doing the people's business. They stay up there and they fight all the time. You didn't see that with Jerry Ford. You didn't see that with Ronald Reagan. Mm. And you didn't see that with George H.W. Bush.
President Reagan and Speaker O'Neill rarely agreed on a thing, but they could find a way to work it.
Absolutely. They didn't agree on anything. But after 5 o'clock, they'd get together and have a drink of Irish whiskey and tell Irish jokes. I was with him.
Maybe we ought to elect more Irishmen. That's a good way to go. Well, we mentioned President Reagan. Let's move on to him just a little bit. I find it kind of ironic that you were in charge of a campaign in 76 that denied his very serious challenge to President Ford for the nomination. And then with your friend 4 years later, George Bush, in the primaries, and yet he selected you as chief of staff. Now, I don't know. You mentioned the tightness of secretaries of state, and I certainly would agree. But I suspect chief of staff has got to be the big appointment, the person closest.
Well, yes.
How did that come about?
Well, I think what it does more than anything else is speak to the broad gauge nature of Ronald Reagan. How comfortable can you be in your own skin to take somebody who's run two campaigns against you and make them your White House chief of staff? Why did he do that? I'll tell you why he did it, because they recognized they needed somebody who knew Washington, D.C. And maybe it didn't hurt that I had been able to prevail for Ford against Reagan.
Yeah.
They might have said, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's something here we ought to take advantage of. But it really speaks to the broad gauge nature of Ronald Reagan. Again, I've said before, a truly lovely human being. What you saw with Ronald Reagan was what you got. He was totally guileless, and he believed the best in everyone. His protector, his guardian, the love of his life was Nancy Reagan, and she was his personnel chief. She could read somebody that was pursuing their own agenda in a heartbeat. She could figure that out, and if anybody did that, they wouldn't be long for that White House, I'll tell you that. And she was very good at that. But Ronald Reagan believed the best of people. And I don't think it hadn't happened before in American politics. I'm not sure it's going to ever happen again.
You know, a lot of people would have anticipated a member of that California faithful, Michael Deaver, Ed Meese, someone like that might have gotten that job. But it went to you, and then you and Deaver developed even a close personal friendship and a good working relationship,
yes,
but I mean personal as well.
Yes, we did.
And it helped, I hope.
Yeah, we did. Well, but, and you know, it may sound a tad arrogant, and I don't mean it to, but there were three of us. It was me as chief of staff. There was Ed Meese as counselor to the president, who had been his chief of staff in California, and really sort of, went high up in his campaign, sort of expected maybe to be chief of staff in Washington, and Mike Deaver, who did the scheduling advance and first lady and stuff like that. We were very close. We had differences, but those differences served Ronald Reagan very well because he heard all sides of the issues. They called us the Troika, and yes, there were some tensions, but I think it ended up serving President Reagan pretty well.
But you came together when, even if you disagreed in the
yes,
Troika
we
meeting.
Did. Yes, we did. But Mike and I were particularly close, and worked very well together. Yeah.
Well, I know we all have a general idea about what Reaganomics meant then, or might even mean different things now, I suppose, but basically lower taxes, less regulation. And so
less regulation, lower taxes.
What did it really mean to the two of you when you were working to get it through the Congress? President
well,
Reagan
we didn't call it Reaganomics. That's something that the press put on it we inherited a terrible situation. When we came in 1981, interest rates were 18%, inflation was 21, or vice versa, whatever it was. The misery index was way up there. And then we got our program enacted by the Congress by August of the first year. And when things didn't turn around like that, they said, well, this is Reaganomics. It's failed. And look how terrible the economy is. Nothing. Well, by the middle of the third year of his first term presidency, Reagan, things turned around dramatically. And we had tremendous economic growth and created millions of new jobs. But the press put the Reaganomics label on it. We didn't, but we did call it tax spending reductions, tax rate reductions, and elimination of excess regulations, waste, fraud, and abuse, and that sort of thing. Now, when I was running George H.W. Bush's campaign against Reagan for the nomination in 1980, we made the mistake of calling President Reagan. He wasn't president then. Governor Reagan's economic program, Voodoo Economics. And don't think I didn't have a problem with that. After becoming chief of staff for President Reagan, we used to kid about it a lot. We'd laugh a little bit about it. But I want to tell you something, and this is true. I've told people this a lot. I saw it work. Everybody, you know, when the press wants to knock it, they call it trickle-down economics or something. Guess what? We turned that economy around and we created hundreds of thousands of good, solid paying jobs. We took 6 million low-income Americans off the rolls, and we had 96 months of sustained non-inflationary growth. So it worked. And I was fortunate enough to be there both as chief of staff, as it worked, and as his treasury secretary. Somebody said to me, you know, it looks to us like you've changed your position from voodoo economics to big cheerleader for Reaganomics. I said, let me tell you something. In Washington, D.C., where you stand is a function of where you sit. And I was sitting in the Treasury Secretary's chair at that time.
Well, that's bringing home the bacon to get to some other old sayings of that nature. Now, kind of a delicate question in a way, but maybe not so much. President Reagan was the victim of an assassination attempt.
Right.
And at that moment there in the Hilton, outside the Hilton where that happened, rushed to the hospital. Vice President was in an airplane. Speaker was elsewhere. And there was a press conference in the White House. Then Secretary of State Alexander Haig, sort of at the end, was asked a question, who's in charge? And his response was, I am. Mm-hmm. And that more or less ended his effectiveness. Now, let me say up front about that I was just glad somebody thought they were. And I'm not astonished that a man who had spent a lifetime in command would not assume a command if there was any opportunity, or not opportunity, but I mean necessity at that point. But he did more or less do that. Whatever you want to say about Secretary Haig in that context, just kind of recreate that whole image there for
well, it was
you're,
a,
you're right there in the middle of all that.
It was an extraordinarily tense time. I was over at the hospital with the president and Nancy, and we were in constant communication with the people in the Situation Room, the cabinet, and with Vice President Bush, who, as you say, was on an airplane coming back to Washington. I was faced with the very difficult decision as to whether or not to invoke the 25th Amendment of the Constitution, which says that when the president's going to be incapacitated, either he will turn over power to the vice president or the cabinet will turn it over, a vote of the cabinet. We decided not to submit the 25th Amendment question to the cabinet for a couple of reasons. Number one, the doctors told us that the president would not be under anesthesia for very long. Secondly, if we'd invoked it, we would have handed the power to the vice president. I'd been the vice president's campaign manager against President Reagan. We were in the second month of our tenure in the White House. Vice President Bush didn't want anybody to think that somehow he was trying to grasp power. When his plane came back to Washington, D.C. and landed at Andrews Air Force Base, they suggested taking the chopper and landing on the south lawn of the White House. The vice president said, I don't do that. That's where the president lands. I'm not going to do that. So there was a lot of sensitivity about this. I conferred with Ed Meese, the counselor of the president, and with Len Nofziger, who at that time was the press secretary. I think maybe with Mike Deaver, I'm not sure. But we opted not to try to invoke the 25th Amendment. Now, the next morning, the president was out of intensive care. He was rational. He signed a bill. We brought a bill over there. So we got a lot of criticism for that. That was, after all, remember, it was the time of the Cold War.
Oh, boy.
And if Soviet Union had launched, maybe then we would have quickly done, you know, but I think at the time it was very much the right thing to do. I know this, it was what Vice President Bush preferred. It's certainly what I preferred. And the Californians were involved as well.
It was a great effort, of course, there to reassure America and
reassure
the world.
Reassure the country.
But what we learned later was that he really was more gravely wounded.
What we learned later was that he almost died of an infection after the surgery. That's what really was very serious. The surgery, the wound and the surgery were corrected fairly quickly, but then he got some sort of an infection. And that never really became public knowledge until later on.
Well, we got him up again and everything's functioning well and we run for re-election and so forth. And then immediately thereafter, you and Treasury Secretary Don Regan swap jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happened?
Why did that happen? Mm-hmm. How did it happen? Well, let me back up and say when President Reagan, after the 1980 election, President-elect Reagan said, pulled me aside, said, Jim, I want to see you before you go back to Texas. We were at the Century Plaza Hotel in L.A. Everybody was celebrating. I went home that night and told my wife, Susan, what he'd said, and she started crying. She said, I'm afraid what this might mean. I went to see the president the next day. He said, I want you to be my chief of staff, but I want you to work it out with Ed Meese. And so Ed and I reached an agreement, an accommodation. We reduced it actually to a little memorandum of understanding about who would have what responsibilities and so forth. I told the president at the time, I said, Mr. President, I'm happy to do it, but I have to tell you, I've been there in the White House in D.C., and this job is best done in two-year increments. People wear out in this job. He said, fine, let's take it on for 2 years. Well, four years and 2 weeks later, I was still there. and that's when Don Regan one day called me. There'd been a leak in the Washington Post that he didn't like, and I was chief of staff, and so he called me raising hell and cussing me out on the phone and said, I'm sending a letter over resigning. And he was an Irishman, and he could lose his temper. He's a good guy, but he'll lose his temper. I took that letter into the president. I showed it to the president and said, I said, Mr. President, let me go over there and talk to him. See if I can't talk him out of this. And President Reagan said, please do. I went over there, and we sort of kissed and made up, and I convinced him not to resign. And he looked at me and he said, you're tired, aren't you? I said, well, wouldn't you be tired after 4 years and 2 weeks in this job, longer than anybody in history had ever held it and not gone to jail? True.
Good lawyer, good yeah. lawyer.
And I said, yeah, I'm tired. He said, I'll tell you what, I got a proposition for you. Why don't we switch jobs? I said, you got to be kidding. He said, no, I'm not kidding. I said, well, let me think about it, and I'll talk to the president about it, and, you know, you better not make the offer again, because I sure might take you up on it. Well, we talked to the president about it. We talked to the first lady about it. I talked to Meese and Deaver. Everybody thought it would be a good idea. Don Regan was Ronald Reagan's favorite cabinet officer. They were a lot alike. They were when we actually made the switch, Mike Deaver, we brought Regan in. Mike Deaver said to President Reagan, he said, Mr. President, I brought you somebody your own age to play with. Just kidding. Deaver had a really close relationship with the president. Anyway, it didn't work out. Everybody went into it with great expectations, but, you know, people need to realize, everybody who's ever been White House Chief of Staff, after they've been a principal, after they've been important in their own right, doesn't do real well. And it's because it's Chief of Staff. Nancy Reagan wrote in her book, Don Regan liked the chief title, but he didn't like the staff title too much. So it didn't work yeah. out, and they ended up running him off, and it's too bad. And that's, you know, some
but
things
worked
happened.
Out on your side.
Iran
you really enjoyed being Secretary.
Well, I enjoyed being Treasury Secretary. I never will forget, once the deal was done, I called George Shultz. He was Secretary of State because he'd been Secretary of Treasury. George Shultz and I had similar career paths. He'd been in the Marine Corps. I was in the Marine. He went to Princeton. I went to Princeton. He'd been in the Marine Corps. I was in the Marine Corps. He'd been Treasury Secretary. I was Treasury Secretary. He'd been Secretary of State. I was Secretary of State. So I called George when he was Secretary of State, and I said, George, I'm going over to Treasury. What can you tell me about the job? And, you know, frankly, that was a good job for me because I'd been a business lawyer. And I knew taxation policy. I knew things like that. George said, it's the best job in government except Secretary of State. He said, it's the best job because nobody tries to get into your sandbox like they do here at State. And you're dealing with esoteric issues, exchange rate coordination, tax policy, and so forth. And it was a very enjoyable 4 years for me.
Well, that's good.
Three and a half, really. I resigned, as you know, to leave and go run George H.W. Yeah. Bush's campaign against Mike Dukakis.
Which is a good transition, because I want to go to him next. President Bush inscribed a photo to you, the man who made me president. That's pretty strong accolade there. And I think I agree with it, because I know of your skills in achieving those kinds of things. But what did you really do to elect George Bush in 1988?
I didn't do much to elect him. He did a lot to elect himself. But we had a good campaign, and we drew a good, we were lucky. We drew an opponent who was very, very liberal and sort of pretty much out of the mainstream. And I knew the election, you know, we started out behind. George and I went to Wyoming so we wouldn't have to listen to the Democratic National Convention and Ann Richards calling him poor George, born with a silver spoon in his mouth yeah. and all that. So we went up to our place and spent some time in the wilderness. But we started out 18 or so points behind. I knew it was all over. And one of the debates, that may have been the first debate, when Bernard Shaw at CNN asked Governor Dukakis, Governor Dukakis, if someone broke into your house and raped and murdered your wife, would you then be for the death penalty? And Dukakis says, Bernie, you know I'm opposed to the death penalty, and yeah. went on to justify his opposition to the death penalty. Well, that was it. It was over. And you could see the numbers. And George Bush is a good campaigner. He's a tough campaigner. Some people said in 92, gee, it didn't seem like he really wanted it. Boy, nothing's further from the truth. I mean, I was his tennis doubles partner. I know how competitive he is. And that was a good campaign. We started out way behind. We ended up winning all but 10 states.
And he was a good president.
Extraordinarily good president. You know what they said the other day, just the other day? Tom Brokaw said on Morning Joe, most underrated American president we've ever had, George H.W. Bush. And you watch what I'm saying. History is really going to treat him well. He was president. I was fortunate to be Secretary of State when the world changed. But he was the president who had to manage that change and make it all happen. We presided over the peaceful end of the Cold War. It didn't have to end peacefully. George Bush knew that he shouldn't dance on the ruins of the Berlin Wall. He got a lot of grief for it. Press was saying, what is wrong with you? Why can't you show more emotion? 40 years we've been fighting this Cold War, now we've won. He knew he had to deal further with Gorbachev and Shevardnadze and the Soviet Union in order to make sure that it ended peacefully. The unification of Germany as a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a tremendous achievement. The coalition that kicked Iraq out of Kuwait. You want a textbook case of the way to fight a war? Look at the way he fought that war. And guess what? We didn't pay for it. We got other countries to pay for it.
And didn't stay too many years after.
We went in, we did what we said we were going to do, and we got out. We suffered casualties, 318. That's any one casualty is too many. But that you look at that, that's a textbook. We brought Israel and all of her Arab neighbors to the table to talk peace for the first time ever. And we got rid of the wars in Central America. So he's got a wonderful legacy, and history's going to treat him extraordinarily well, even though he was a one-term president.
Yeah. I agree with you, and that sometimes happens. I know from history, Harry Truman was, left office with about 20% approval rating, and then he turned out to be, I believe, the president that President Reagan quoted almost as much
a lot
of them put together.
Yeah. A lot.
Well, I want to talk about that Berlin Wall in a minute, but first I want to get into the Secretary of State's stuff, because I think you really enjoyed that job and achieved a lot in that job. But the one thing I really want to ask you, how do you put up with the travel? I mean, you go virtually.
Well, if there are any doctors in the audience, they're not going to like this answer.
Okay.
But I took Halcyon. And that was, at that time, they came out later and said, this is a terrible drug, very bad for you. Boy, it sure worked for me. I would take it, and I would get, I had, of course, a wonderful airplane, big 707 with a stateroom where I could sleep and Air Force stewards and all the rest. But I'd take a Halcyon, and I'd get 6 hours solid sleep going from one country to another, and I wouldn't have a hangover. Nothing, no ill effects. It treated me very well. But it is debilitating. It's a tough job. You look at some of the people as they age in that job, and it's a tough job. There's a lot of travel. I think I went 750,000 miles in 3.5 years.
That's a lot of flight. That much frequent flyer get you a good hotel somewhere. The fall of the end of the Cold War, but the symbol is the wall. I might have to be as gray-haired as we are to really appreciate what the presence of that wall meant to the world, and especially to us, as obviously not as much as the Germans, but more than anyone else, from 1962 to 1989. That has to be a high point of your tenure there in that job.
Yeah, it was. Well, let me tell you why I think the wall fell and why I think we won the Cold War. I think we owe a great debt of gratitude to every American president from 1962 on, Democrat or Republican, who were steadfast in our fight, in our Cold War effort. And we also ought to recognize that while we contributed, and our allies, the British, the French, and others, it was the people of the captive nations of Eastern and Central Europe, and particularly the German Democratic Republic, whose thirst for freedom and desire for freedom meant they were never going to remain subjugated to the authoritarian, totalitarian nature of the Soviet Union. And then the last group that I think deserves some credit are the Soviet leaders themselves at the time. Gorbachev today is very unpopular in Russia, because they're no longer a superpower, and they blame him for the loss of their superpower status. Edward Shevardnadze, the foreign minister with whom I dealt so closely.
And good friend.
And good, wonderful, close friend of mine, is not highly regarded anymore in his home country. But these were the men above all, the Politburo generally, but it was Gorbachev and Shevardnadze first and foremost, who said, we are not going to use force to keep the empire together. And for years, the Soviet Union had been kept together by force. And so the Soviet Union imploded when I was Secretary of State. One of the first things I did when that happened in December of 1991, and Yeltsin took over from Gorbachev as head of the Russian Federation, 13 new republics came to life, 13 new nations, boom, right there. And they all, you know, we had to make sure that the nuclear weapons that were on their territory were not proliferated, and we did that. And we wanted to make sure we were the first country to open embassies in all of those countries, and we did that. And I flew to every one of those remote capitals. But all of those people deserve great credit for the end of the Cold War and the collapse of communism.
You know, there's a touching story there when I read your autobiography. When you called, when this is going on, and you called the German foreign minister, the secretary very excitedly said, thank you for everything.
Yeah.
Now, that choked me up when I read that.
She was crying. She was crying. I had, I think I had placed a call. I don't think he was calling me. No, I think I was calling him. His secretary came on the phone, and she was crying, and she said, Mr. Secretary, on behalf of the German people, I want to thank you for what you've done for us. And I'll get you, Minister Genscher. So, yeah, I mean, and even today, there's a great feeling of affection for America in Germany, the unified Germany. Without us, that could never have happened. The British were reluctant, the French were reluctant, the Soviets were opposed, because they were all worried that history would repeat itself. If we had a unified Germany, after all, there had been two world wars started by Germany. So they were very nervous, but we were not. And our view was pretty much, George Bush's view was pretty much this, hey, look, we've been talking for 40 years about bringing peace and freedom to the captive nations of Central and Eastern Europe. We came back off now. Now we have a chance to try and make it happen. So we led the way, and we got it to happen in a very narrow window of opportunity.
A couple of quick questions, perhaps, maybe quick, about politics of the last 30 years. I think you and I share a view about special prosecutors.
Yeah.
I've kind of heard you comment just a little bit earlier about the post-Watergate stuff. You think it's a good thing that that's over with?
Well, I'll tell you who thinks it's a good thing that the special prosecutor law has lapsed, and that's William Jefferson Clinton. And guess what? President Clinton is a man of a great ability and a really good, he did a lot of good things as president. I don't mean this to be a knock on him. But he renewed that special prosecutor's law at a time when it was about to expire, and I know darn good well he's sorry he did it. Yeah. The special prosecutor's law is a terrible law. It's an awful law. It's what it in effect said, if you just get one allegation from what is a credible source against a high-ranking government official, if you were above a certain rank, you were subject to this law, then there would be a special prosecutor appointed and there'd be a special investigation of you. And politicians quickly found out that the best way to beat their opponent was to get them indicted by a special prosecutor. And so we had a lot of that happening, but it worked both ways. It worked against Republicans, and it worked against Democrats. In the Ford campaign against Carter, his own attorney general appointed a special prosecutor during the course of the campaign. I argued loud and long, this is a perversion of the political process, to have a special prosecutor appointed for the President of the United States in the heat of a presidential campaign. But anyway, it's a good thing for the country that it's gone, and I think both Republicans and Democrats appreciate it.
And we really do have a court system, and we really do have an impeachment process if necessary.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we're going to conclude here just with this question, although there's a little bit more business to do. A lot of people are saying or have said that the last century was the American century, and that this one is going to belong to China, India, maybe Brazil, take your pick. Where do you think America is in the world still today?
Well, I'm not one who buys into all this talk about America's decline. We are still the preeminent power in the world, and we're going to remain the preeminent power for a long time, provided, one big but, we got to take care of our debt problem. We're broke. We're spending like drunken sailors. We got to stop that. And we got to... And so we got to find a way to cut spending. You can't be strong politically, militarily, or diplomatically if you're not strong economically. It was the economy, this wonderful engine of ours, that made this country what it is. But I don't buy this argument that somehow we're going to be displaced on the world scene by China or India or Brazil or anybody else. I will say that we've moved from a bipolar world during the Cold War to a short period of a unipolar world. When I was privileged to be Secretary of State, it was a unipolar world. Everybody wanted to get close to Uncle Whiskers because we were the sole remaining superpower. Now we're in a multipolar world. That's not something that we should resent or think is bad, because the reason these other countries are coming up is because they have embraced our paradigm of the free market. That's why China's moving. That's why India is, and Brazil, and so forth. So we ought to welcome that. We're still going to remain the preeminent power for a long time, provided we get our fiscal house in order, our economic house in order. And one other thing, provided we find a way to get back to the kind of politics that Gerry Ford and Ronald Reagan and George Bush and George Bush 43 practiced when they were up there, where they were willing to reach across the aisle and try and make a deal with the other side so that government could function the way the American people want it to function. We got to cure our economic dysfunction, and we got to cure our political dysfunction.
I think I'll lead the applause on that one. Our distinguished guest, Secretary Baker, has been one of the leading citizens of our country and of our world during the last quarter of the 20th century and the beginning of this one. Our time is substantially the way it is because of his efforts and influence. No other American shouldered so much responsibility or wielded so much power for so long in an elected democracy. Like that battery bunny, Secretary Baker just kept on going from one administration to the next, balancing governing with elective politics, something sadly beyond so many of the other folks that we've selected sometimes. Secretary Baker did so with such skill and success that he is honored not just in our country, but in every capital of the world, and tonight especially in Nacogdoches. So we are pleased that you've been here with us, sir, that you stopped by, gave us one more good glimpse for our students of what it's going to take to make our country continue to be free and successful. So now I'll ask President Baker Petillo to rejoin us for our special presentation.
On April the 20th, 2010, the SFA Board of Regents approved a new award. The award is to be known as the Lifetime Cultural Achievement Award. This award is to be presented annually to a person of significance who makes a speech, a talk, an address, or engages in public conversation about the culture and the impact that the culture has had upon them. Tonight, it is very apparent that Secretary Baker has been very involved in helping develop the culture in this nation for many, many years. And so tonight, we would like to say to you, Secretary Baker, you have honored us for many years by serving America, and tonight we would like to honor you by awarding to you from Stephen F. Austin State University this Lifetime Cultural Achievement Award.
Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. I'm going to let you hold it up. Yeah, I will.
Come on, get in the picture. Get over here in the picture.
That'll be a good picture.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Archie MacDonald Speaker Series, recorded for broadcast on April 12, 2012, at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas. Archie's guest tonight was the Honorable James A. Baker III. This program was recorded for broadcast by the Radio and Television Program at Stephen F. Austin State University. The post-production engineer and producer of the program was Bill Beckett, and this has been a production of Red River Radio. We are a community-supported public broadcasting service of LSUS.